Good evening.
Good evening.
Everybody have a good day?
Sir.
Do we need Dr. Seuss today, Ron?
Only this morning.
Only this morning. Very quickly, let's see if I left this up here. Everything that we're doing in the class or in our worship service is already up online. I just want to mention that before we get started. And the link is in the bulletin. Are there any copies of the bulletin out there if you didn't get it? But if you go to our Facebook page, the Dahlonega Church Facebook page, you'll find the links. I think I posted that to the church group, and I'll post that to the main page later. But all the materials up here, and I'm working on creating a site for the morning and evening class for the one that we're doing now. So the one for James on Wednesday night is already up, and this one is already up for our Sunday morning series, and the other one will be up later. So everything's going to be archived like we usually do. All right, what we started doing last week and what we continued this morning, and we're in the second part of the second lesson, is focusing on principles that lie behind the biblical text, foundational things. I mentioned this last week. You go up to a house and people want to show you around the house. If it's a one-floor house, you know, they really don't usually take in the crawl space and let you investigate the foundation and see all the footers and all the rebar and everything that's in there in order to make it stand and be rather solid. When we think about that, we think, well, that's just a given. It's got to be there. In order for this building to stand, something has to be beneath it in order for it to be supported. And that's the sort of thing we're looking at when we're studying principle faith Genesis. We're looking at things that are foundational to the things that we actually see in the text. I mentioned this last week. I'm going to repeat it now, and we'll probably say it several times. We're trying to read in between the lines. We're trying to see what's there and understand what it presupposes that's necessary in order for what's there to be there. And so we mentioned, for example, the whole notion of how communication works. That's a given. The background and the people to whom this was addressed, that's initially written, that's a given. That's part of the context. That's part of the background. So I'll briefly hit some of these things. We talked about these at the end of the class time. When it says in the beginning, there's not a time stamp there. And incidentally, there are multiple texts in Scripture that start that way, that call you back to this passage in Genesis chapter 1. And so John does the same sort of thing in the book of John in the first verse. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Well, the beginning phrase there is reminiscent of what we see in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. So we noted earlier today that there are lots of signposts along the way that call attention to something that was mentioned before, but with a twist as it moves forward. And so as you're driving down the highway, the mile marker changes. You've got mile 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, usually every tenth of a mile. As you read through the scriptures in the book of Genesis about 10 times, you'll see this is the generations, or this is the genealogy of. Only it shifts from the first time to the second time, the third time, moves on to the next series of genealogies. So there's a mile marker, signpost to say, we're moving the story forward, and I hope you're following along up to this point. And then as it gets to the next segment of genealogical historical concerns, it'll start the same thing again, only it's going to apply to the next group of people. So when you read those things, you're just seeing words on the page, but sometimes the words are repeated in such a way to form a pattern that helps you draw you into the text. And that's just one of the things that you're going to see. So very quickly, the things that we noticed this morning, time and eternity are different. Time is distinct from eternity. Eternity is timelessness, not defined by time. I used the illustration of a ray. It starts at a point, goes off in one direction ad infinitum, it doesn't stop. And if you have a point and you have a ray going one direction and another one going the opposite direction, it reaches both directions without end. And that's a concept that you can't draw that. You can't draw that in a geometry, you know, quiz that you have. You know, show me how this works. What's a ray? Well, you can have, you know, a point. You can draw it off, and you have an arrow indicating it continues. But how far does it continue? Well, it doesn't stop. And so the concept of timelessness is different to us. And the point that's addressed in the beginning of the text is that God stands in contradistinction to the notion of time. He knows what time is. He affects things in the context of time. But he's not bound by time. So in the beginning, from the standpoint of what happens in creation, this is what God did. Not a part of the creation. Again, we mentioned part of the Roman and Greek mythology of their gods was that their gods were part of the created universe. They didn't create the universe, they were part of it, just on a higher level. And that's not saying every concept of deities in other religions were in the same thing, but this is very distinct. God is not part of the creation. So all of these things we mentioned before, metaphysical things don't have a beginning. Only that which has physical time and place has a beginning point. Something that's neither bound by time nor space is timeless and by definition eternal. There's much more to it than that. So all of these things were addressed at the beginning, and we want to drop down to the next point because that's the last thing that we were mentioning at the end. This scrolls a little too fast sometimes for me. All right. I think I've got this too big to keep it doing that. All right. Keeps jumping ahead. All right. Wanted to go back. It likes to jump from one page to the next. Ah, I know what the problem is. Let me change this very quickly. And my preference is the way I have it set to scroll. There we go. I'll just have this as a single scroll so it's not going to give me that grief. All right, so let's see if this solves the problem. Good. All right. So at the very end, God's distinct from time, transcends time, but he's very much aware of time. He acts in time. How can something, the nature of Father, Son, and Spirit, that's outside of time, function in such a way to impact things that are in time? Well, part of the reason is that God has created things by the power of his word, being infinite in all respects, so that he's able to do that. And that's one of the incredible things that's brought out in the biblical text repeatedly, is that the God that we are speaking about is not just a superhuman being with superhuman features and strengths that are limited and vary from one quote-unquote superhuman being to the others, and talking about the gods in the Greek and Roman pantheon, but he's greater than all of them individually and combined in such that everything that exists owes its existence to God. And so that's assumed when you start reading the book of Genesis, and that's what the children of Israel would have understood. And so that he is aware of time and acts in time is significant because that's the message that the children of Israel need to understand. We've been enslaved in the land of Egypt for a long time. It's been 400 plus years from the time of the promise made to Abraham to the time of the deliverance, the exodus from the book of exodus from the country of Egypt, as is reflected in the book that bears that name, Exodus. And we don't see that anything different's going to change. We're enslaved here, and this is the way it's always going to be. And so God acts in time through the apostles, if you were, one sent with a message, Aaron and especially Moses, to call attention to the fact that God's going to act in the context of time and release them from where they are. Well, that's kind of a big pill to swallow. If you look at the numbers of the priest alone are 603,550. And the priests are only numbered starting at age 20, and there's a cutoff point about 55 to 60. So how many men were there total? Don't know. Not counting anybody older than that, not counting anybody younger than that, not counting any of the women, not counting any of the children. And so estimates have ranged from 2.5 to 5 million people that comprise the nation of Israel in bondage in the land of Egypt. And they're being told that God's going to deliver them. 2.5 to 5 million people from bondage in a land in which they've been enslaved for a few hundred years. And that's a pretty big pill to swallow. And you could see Moses running into some objections in the people saying, yeah, really, this is going to happen? This is what's going to be done? And as Moses continues going before Pharaoh and makes repeated pleas with plagues that follow that back up what he's going to say, the children of Israel get a little upset. They don't see an end game coming. In fact, things are getting worse. Because what does Pharaoh do? He ramps up the persecution. He ramps up the requirements. Listen, before we had you building all the bricks and putting everything together for all these cities that we're building, and everything was supplied for you, now you go get the raw materials and still keep up the pace. Well, that's not going to go over very well for the people that you're trying to say that God's going to free you from this. And so that dynamic is in play. And they are being told, let me remind you that the God who created everything is in control of everything that he created, even what's going on in the context of the things that you're facing in life. Well, that's a pretty big thing to sell to somebody. How are you going to prove that? Well, God's going to prove it. And so the series of plagues do multiple things. One, it demonstrates to Pharaoh that he's not in control like he thinks he is. And it demonstrates to the children of Israel who were witnessing these things, say, whoa, our God did that? Our God did that? 10 times our God did that. Now, that doesn't mean they're thoroughly and ultimately convinced, because as they leave and they get towards the Red Sea and they're ready to cross, the Egyptians are hot on their heels. And God delivers them again. And so the God who created is the God who acts in the context of time for the benefit of those people who are willing to submit to him. And when I say submit to him, I don't mean become slaves again in the sense that they were in the land of Egypt, but who voluntarily submit to him for something that's even greater than being independent of God. So that message has roots in the opening verses of the book of Genesis that should have had dramatic impact on the Jews who are reading this for the first time. Just a reminder, they are enslaved in Egypt as Moses is writing these things. And or they are, as you get out of the book of Genesis and Exodus, in Numbers, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, they are traveling away from Egypt en route to the land of Canaan. And from their perspective, some of them anyway, things weren't a whole lot better. We don't have food. We wish we were back in Egypt. Well, what? We had food there. We may have been enslaved, but we remember the leeks and the onions that we ate when we were there. We were slaves. We were treated like slaves, and we couldn't do whatever we want, but we had food. We're out in the middle of nowhere here, and you're asking this God who's freed us to sustain us. And of course, God does, providing the manna daily. They didn't have any diseases that impacted them for the 40 years that were wandering in the wilderness. Their clothes didn't wear out. Their shoes didn't wear out. God led them away from natural enemies that would have taken their breath away, so to speak, from the standpoint of having the confidence to do what they needed to do to go to the land of Canaan. The point is, all of that then is backed up by the history of who God was before, starting in creation. So all of these things are incredible. God is acting in the context of time to benefit his children. And hopefully that's going to impact them. All right, so I keep scrolling too far. Let me slow down just a little bit here and try to get this. I'm moving too fast. I got to change something. Did I do that? Okay, so we mentioned at the very end about God's functioning outside of time, that God lives outside of time but functions in time. But it's interesting that God is discoverable in the context of time. When Paul spoke to the Athenians in Mars Hill in Acts chapter 17, God said he's not far from any one of you. It's not like you can reach out and grab God. But his point was, the evidence of God's existence is demonstrated by his physical creation, and also by the fact that you, as part of that physical creation, are made in the likeness of his image, as well as the purposes that God has that are being manifested at that time and in other times. And so God's discoverable in the context of time. How do you see God? You may not remember this if you're very young, but Russian cosmonauts made a big deal saying when they were in space once, they looked everywhere and saw no evidence of God. They didn't see God there, all right? I'm not trying to be corny, not trying to be cute and snarky here, but has anybody seen their brain? I didn't know you have one. Some people act like they might not have one. My point is, there are lots of things that can be known to exist without having to see them physically in order to know that they exist. You know, that house that's built here, there must be a foundation. It doesn't just rest on the dirt, else it's going to fall. You know, the whole point of building on a foundation. And so there's some things that can be, you can draw conclusions on based upon the evidence that's around us. And don't want to get into the physics of all this, but, you know, Einstein's concept of E equals MC squared demonstrates that there are forces that are in play that indicate that relativity functions in the universe, indicating that the universe is not infinite, as was commonly believed before, that it's bound by the constraints of time. One of the models that existed before he popularized that, and this goes way back in the early 1900s, was that the world and the universe was infinite and it constantly expanding, and time was eternal. And he said, well, that doesn't make any sense. The second law of thermodynamics demands that things are running down over a period of time. They're getting slower. They're getting more chaotic as opposed to becoming more uniform. And so the point is, there are things, evidences in the world that indicate that there's something about an origin, a point in time in which everything began. All right, God measures time differently. That doesn't mean that God has a bad watch. and that God works, uses bad chronometers. It means that the way things work in a cycle of time are different than the way we want things to be done. We live in the an age of the immediate. I want something now. Now I push this button, it's done now. I click this link, it's done now. And so Moses served 40 years in the context of Pharaoh's household, 40 years in the wilderness, and 40 years leading the children of Israel. That's a long time to wait for something to happen. It was 25 years between the time that the promise was initially made to Abraham and the time that it was fulfilled. And so the context of 2 Peter chapter 3 addresses that. Some people have said, well, it hasn't happened yet, so it's never going to happen. Now think about that model. One of the philosophies that was popular in the Greek culture and science of the day of the New Testament was that things are changeless. Nothing ever changes. And because nothing has happened today, it can't happen tomorrow. Well, that means, you know, there's nothing that's going to move forward weather-wise, health-wise, anything. If everything is static and has to remain just as it is, then children don't grow up. And so something happens in the course of time that allows things to change. And the point is, in the context of time of those things changing, God acts. How does he do so? Providentially, by means of his Spirit. There are other things to be discussed in that. The other thing is, God's not only distinct from time, but God's not trapped in matter. We alluded to this morning, that much of the gods of ancient mythology, and when I use that term, I'm not trying to be derogatory, it's just that's the term that's often used in Greek and Roman culture, popular in the first century and even before that, gods were regional, gods were local, gods were limited from the standpoint of the physical abilities that were attributed to that. There's a god of the sun, the moon, stars, the mountains, the rivers, and almost every other kind of physical location that you could identify. But in the context of Scripture, the God that stands outside of time also stands outside of the matter that he's created. Now, how does that happen? Well, there's a whole lot more that we would have to go into. But part of this mindset is impacting the children of Israel who first read or heard this. The God that we serve is not like the God of the river. What's the significance of that? That's part of the plagues that's demonstrated during the time of Moses going before Pharaoh. He's not like the God of the frogs. He's not like any of the gods that are addressed in the context of dealing with the Egyptian pantheon at that time. He's different from them, distinct from creation. And that's the God that's going to sustain you. Well, that was a lesson that the Egyptians had to learn. That was a lesson that the children of Israel had to be reconvinced of. So again, God created. He, the creator, is not part of the creation. He's not self-created. He didn't bring himself into existence. And so that's an oxymoron. That's not logically consistent. And so in ancient thought, gods were part of the creation, not distinct. In ancient thought, gods were subject to everything that creation is subject to. So they weren't infinite. They did not self-create. They did not create the world. So one of the models that's been adopted in order to explain things is that there was an ultimate creator God that was less than the one God. And the reason why things came into being was that there were a series of emanations from that God, demiurges they're often referred to, and that the creation came way down the line, totally remote from God. That's consistent with the idea of deism, but it's not consistent with the idea that that reflects a unique God. So the essence of God does not equate with the essence of creation. And the point is there's an essence that's different. The New Testament uses the term ontos. O-N-T-O-S is how you would transliterate it. And it's part of the concept of ontology. You might say, well, that's a 50-cent word I really don't care to know about. But all it means is talking about the ultimate essence of things. What defines what this is and why it is and how it functions in the physical world? We would use the word nature. We see other terms, physis, for example, from which the word physics comes, is related to the term nature. But this is talking about a metaphysical essence that makes everything work the way it does. So I mentioned this before, and I wasn't trying to be cute when I said that. You know, there are lots of things that exist that we don't see. Question, can you touch a law? Can you touch a physical law? When we talk about the speed of light, can you touch that? No, but it's measurable. How do you know that's measurable? Can you measure gravity? Yeah, but can you see it? Well, no, but if I push this off of this precipice, it's going to fall, and you can calculate the speed at which it falls. And so how do all of those things work? They're all kinds of mathematical and scientific constants that are measurable but aren't touchable. I can't touch E equals MC squared. I can't touch the rate of acceleration per second per second. I can't touch any of those things. The whole Heisenberg uncertainty principle says that you can measure position and you can measure speed, but you can't measure both of them simultaneously. Where's that idea come from? It's part of the nature of the world that exists, all of which are metaphysical. Now that's interesting. The laws by which the physical world are governed are not trapped into the physical world, but govern the physical world, which means they stand outside of the physical world itself in some way. Now, I'm not trying to make them infinite or eternalized as God, but my point is there are lots of things that are going on that we don't see. All right, I forget the guy's name, Ralph, one of the stars of the Waltons, years and years ago when cellular service was big. His granddaughter was introducing to him, this is a commercial, about how cell phones worked. And she held up the phone, she says, "Grandpa, it's connected." And he grabbed the phone, mine's in there, he grabbed it and did this with his hands, trying to feel, I don't feel any wires. You know, how can it be connected? You know, it's not connected by means of physical tethers or anything, but there's connections that's there. And so you don't see that. It's beyond the field and the realm of our vision. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And yet they are physical. So there are physical things that are beyond the perception of my eyes. Is that possible? Does that indicate that there are metaphysical things that might also exist? And that's just talking about some of those things concerning laws. All right. So the essence of God is that he is not equated or identical on the same plane that his creation is. So there is something that's necessary and infinite versus something that's unnecessary and finite. And so the reason the world has to have something beyond itself to exist is the principle of cause and effect. The principle of cause and effect that's axiomatic is that the cause has to be greater than the effect. Effects can create other effects that are subordinate to them, but ultimately there's a unmoved mover or primed mover, as we mentioned before. And so all of these things that we've addressed in the context of Scripture are assumed to undergird what we're reading as we read Scripture. And then it says, in the beginning, God created. So there's a timestamp from the standpoint of how history is monitored in Scripture. God is described as being a personal God. That doesn't come all in the first verse. But he acts, and it's an act of power. It's an act of mind. It's an act of intelligence. It's an act of benevolence. Now, you don't see that all in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, but it's going to be introduced later. One of the ways, let me encourage you to do something just as a point. Turn to the book of Colossians, all right? And in the book of Colossians, there is a segue, and this is not just in Colossians, it's everywhere in the text. There's a segue between the identity of deity, in this case the Christ, and the identity and the role that this Christ plays in redemption. So I'm just going to hit a few highlights starting in verse 9. All right, these things are spelled out because we have a knowledge of his will and wisdom and spiritual understanding, that you're going to walk worthy of him and so forth, strengthened with all might. Jump down to verse 11. We give thanks to the Father. He's qualified. That's an incredible concept, to be partakers of the inheritance of saints and the light. The point is, spiritually speaking, we become more like God. He's delivered us from the power of darkness and translated us, incredible concept, into the kingdom of the Son of his love. That's speaking about the spiritual kingdom. Now watch the language that's used here. In whom, that's the Son of his love, in whom we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invisible God, which means he's the essence of him. Doesn't mean he looks like God in a physical sense. The firstborn over all creation. Now watch what it says here. Firstborn means he's the source of creation. Book of Revelation 3 does the same thing. Now watch the language. For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible. Now, it doesn't say he made cell towers. It didn't say he made, you know, all that stuff to work. But the point is, there are things that you see and that you don't see that are still part of the physical creation. But watch how it segues. Visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things. And that doesn't mean before all things just from the standpoint of time, but it means that he is the prime mover, the unmoved mover, and he's greater than all things. And in him all things consist. So there are two models with reference to creation brought here, the origin of it and the sustainer of it. 2 Peter 3 does the same thing. And then watch how it switches so quickly from the end of verse 16. He's before all things, and verse 17, in him all things consist. And then watch what it does in verse 18. And he's the head of the body, the church. wait a minute, you just went from the creator of everything and the sustainer of everything to say he's the head of the church, which is his body, the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he may have the preeminence. That model of showing Christ in a role as creator and switching very quickly to redeemer says the same God who made everything out of nothing has remade you in his image. And that's everywhere in the New Testament. And so that's introduced in principle in the very first verse of Genesis. God's creative ability has something to do with God's saving ability everywhere in the biblical text. That's not accidental. That's intentional. What God did in demonstrating his power by means of the plagues brought against the Egyptians to free the children of Israel was to show, if God can do this physically, can you imagine what God can do spiritually? That's everywhere. And it starts here, and it goes forward throughout the text. So creation is an act of power. It's an act of mind and intelligence. It's an act of benevolence. That's going to be spelled out later. It's an act of will on God's part, obviously. It's an act of ultimate concern that the things have been arranged the way they are. Let me get you to turn to another passage. This one in the book of Acts. So Paul is traveling in one of his missionary journeys. And, you know, occasionally he runs into some difficulties here and there. And he's speaking in this context in Acts chapter 14. Let's go to verse 8, and I'm going to hit the highlights very quickly. I'm not going to read it verbatim. So a man's there, and he heals the man. And people saw what he did after he healed him. This is verse 8, 9, and 10. The people that saw it, they looked at this, and they said, the gods, look at the language, the gods have come down to us in the likeness of man. That's consistent with the mythology of the day. The gods are super gods, have come to look like us because they are just us on a larger scale. They're super gods, so to speak. And so that's what they assume, like it's part of the Greek and Roman pantheon. So Barnabas they called Zeus, that's the head of the gods, and Paul Hermes, the messenger of God, because he's the chief speaker. And then the priest of Zeus. And so worshiping these deities in the pantheon, whose temples in front of their city brought oxen and garlands and gates and so forth, they're going to offer sacrifice. Why? They saw Paul heal somebody. And they thought, whoa, you must be part of the Greek mythology and the gods and so forth. We're going to worship you. And so Paul saw that and tried to get him to stop. Now watch what he says. Why are you doing these things? Verse 15. We also are men, the language here is powerful, with the same nature as you are. I'm a man just like you are. You can touch me, you can hear me, you can feel me, I feel, I cry, I eat, you know, all these kind of things. We're just like you are, all right? He says, we're men with the same nature as you are and preach to you. So here's what's different about us, not the essence of what we are physically, but the message that we convey. Preach to you that you should turn from these vain things. What's vain? Thinking that we're a God, that when we look nothing more than the way you look. We encourage you to turn to the living God. All right, these individuals will die, so they're not living in perpetuity. How do they describe the God? Watch, who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all things that are in them. That's incredible. So he talks to people who are of a totally different background religiously, and one of the things he starts with is the nature of God as creator, not done, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. People did whatever they want, you know, not just the children of Israel in the times of the judges. Now watch this. This is powerful. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, which is another way of saying he left a witness. Well, what's the witness? Read on. In that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. And with these sayings, they could scarcely restrain the multitudes from sacrificing to them. So one of the things that's brought out in this, I mentioned that creation is an act and sustaining is an act of benevolence. In this context, Paul points to the general benevolence of God. All right, do hurricanes occur? Yes. Do tsunamis occur? Yes. Tornadoes occur. All kinds of natural disasters occur. Question, do they occur nonstop everywhere on the surface of the planet all at the same time, endlessly? No. They occur. And they do some damage, don't get me wrong. But they don't occur all the time. Generally speaking, the principle that's brought out here, and that's what Paul's arguing for, generally speaking, the world's a good place for you to sustain yourself physically. And it fills you not only with food, but fills your heart with gladness. You know, we have a privilege, and I'm not saying you can't see this anywhere else. We have a privilege of where we are in this point in time in history, and where we are on the place on the surface of the map. But we live in a place that's kind of neat. Every time I look out my back window and I look at the mountains, it's just dramatically different all the time. Sun's here, sun's there, shadow's here, sun's there, and I'm taking pictures of it constantly. My kids are going to go crazy. Dad, it's the same view all the time. Yeah, but it looks different all the time. It's just wondrous to behold. And driving down the road, we dropped something off at Sharon and Reggie's house today and went up a different way to go home. And Evelyn says, I love driving this way. It looks different. It's just gorgeous to see. The world is a beautiful place, generally speaking. Does that mean everything that happens on an ongoing basis is always perfect? No, but Paul points to the general benevolence of God in this context to say, God's allowed you to live in this vessel, so to speak, the entirety of his creation, and it's a good place to be. Now, what's he saying there? There's something good about God's that needs to be respected, the one true God. So that act of benevolence is demonstrated everywhere. All right, so let's talk about the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, talked about that, God acted, created, and he created the heavens and the earth. And so the term cosmos that's used here simply means the created world. And it's not just the world on which we live, but the incredible vast universe, some of which we're discovering and learning about on a regular basis. If you keep up with that kind of stuff, the planetary spacecraft that are sent out to study the universe, it's incredible. Huge black holes discovered just recently, and that's intriguing to see how vast everything is.
Voyager is still trucking.
Still go, yeah, some things go back and they go out 15, 20 years later, they're still sending back messages of things they're discovering. The thing is, he's saying the physical world isn't eternal. It's time-bound, and again, that's part of the whole theory of relativity that was introduced by Einstein that really threw a monkey wrench in things. If you read Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, he says that science moves not in methodical advances, but sometimes there's just somebody throws a monkey wrench into something and they come up with a whole new paradigm. And that whole paradigm shifting and changing is what happened in part when Einstein said, no, this world's not eternal. It's not infinite. There are restrictions to it. And it's bound by time. It's not timeless. Well, science took a long time, or at least contemporary science took a long time to come to that point. So it's contingent. And something that's contingent means it's dependent for its existence on somebody else. You know, every last one of us came into this world as a contingent, very dependent being. Little kids can't take care of themselves. We're not like, you know, some, you know, baby animals, birds or whatever, that in a matter of days or weeks, they're gone. You know, we take a long time to nurture and to sustain. And so that element of contingency defines not only us, but the world on a larger scale. So we've noticed this already. And that's this, that time and space are constructs that define a finite world rather than an infinite world. Well, what's an infinite world like? We don't know. You know, we think about, you know, length and width and height and depth and so forth, three dimensions. But something beyond that is a matter of speculation. We don't fully understand all of those things. But they're both created. They're both contingent. So everything that exists physically and spatially is dependent on something else. And everything is dependent on something not only with reference to space, but with reference to time. But metaphysical things are transcended to that. Now, I'm going to segue from something and not really move off the topic, but I want to come back to it. There was a model of philosophy and science that was very popular about 100 years ago, in the first 20 to 25 years of the 20th century, so 1900 to 1920. And this philosophy, this science, and there were many popular people that were involved in that, Edgar Sheffield Brightman of Boston University, perhaps most notable was Russell, who was a scientist and a mathematician as well as a philosopher, Bertrand Russell. And their mindset was this: if it's not physically immediately demonstrable, and if it's not immediately demonstrated by means of math or science, then everything else was irrational. Everything that was not touchable, feelable, measurable, quantifiable, or not immediately deduced by means of scientific or mathematical principles was irrational. And what that did in effect was it just gutted the possibility of anything metaphysical. Gutted the possibility of anything metaphysical. Now, this may sound, you know, too much to grasp, but Russell was asked to defend that. How do you know that? And what's your proof of it? And so he wrote long books. I mentioned before that he was involved in writing a two-volume set called Principia Mathematica, the whole point of which was to prove that math was real, that you could do math. You know, they said, well, you know, mathematics, you can't touch math, you can't measure math, but his point was it's intrinsic to the nature of the world in which we live. So how do you sustain that? It's not, you can't touch 2 plus 2. You can look at two apples and touch two apples and two more apples and say, I got four of them together. But the concept of two, you can't touch. You say, well, I can visualize it. But the concept of two-ness exists independent of you visualizing it. The point is, it's an idea. And to be able to add, subtract, multiply, and divide, all the other things that you can do mathematically and so forth, sine, cosine, tangent, all that kind of stuff, those are all ideas that are axiomatic, but given the world in which we live, you can't touch those. So his whole point was there's a reality to them that is just as real as the world that I can see and that I can touch. And so somebody said, what is the basic principle that governs everything in the physical world that proves you're right? You know what his conclusion was? Well, Mr. Scientist would know this. Science functions based upon the inductive method, not the deductive method, in which you come up with ideas and theories and you run them through testing to develop a hypothesis. And somebody said, you just said you were going to prove that something within the physical world was proof that the physical world was all that there is, and what you cited as proof of it was an idea, a methodology that you can't see or touch. And so that's interesting. The point was, in order to sustain the idea that the world was physical, he went outside of the world in order to try to explain it. And so theory of evolution does the same thing. It's an idea that assumes things outside of the physical world are responsible in part for what's going on. That's an oversimplification, I understand that. But my point is, the people who were reading this for the first time understood that an infinite God was responsible for the world in which they lived, and moreover, was responsible for how he was going to deliver them physically, multiplied millions, from this part of the world to this part of the world, moving from Egypt across the Sinai into the land of Canaan. And they were convinced of that in part by, this is what God has done in the course of history that you are well aware of. And so the history that they learn about from Adam and Eve, and then later from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the 12 tribes, all of which they were descendants of in the land of Egypt, was trying to get them to see the God who acted then is the God who's going to act now, at that time, to release you from Egyptian bondage and take you to this place. And some people were doubtful of it. And so there was repeated elements of conviction that were brought out by means of the miracles done in Egypt, in the Sinai, as they're going through the wilderness, and then ultimately to the land of Canaan. And so that's the background of who was reading this at the very beginning. So one of the things we're going to mention at the very end, and I don't want to read all these passages because you can see there's scores of that are mentioned there, is that the nature of God was inherently relational. Now, what do I mean by that? That there's a mindset that uses the term monotheism. So dualism is two things, and Trinity is three things, and monotheism assumes one. And so, generally speaking, the God that's a part of the Muslim philosophy and religion, Islam, is a monotheistic God. There is no Son, no Spirit. It's God. That's it. But what's interesting in the nature of this, of the biblical text, is God is introduced from the very beginning as intrinsically relational. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, let me get you to look at my Bible. It's right here. If you look in the book of Genesis, watch the way the text reads and the nature of the relationship that's built into the Godhead is explored and explained and expanded upon, extrapolated, if you will, in order to get the children of Israel to see something in the very nature of God is going to be shared to you in such a way that you see you're going to be part of that interrelational dynamic. So, it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And so, the term that's used there is Elohim, which is plural. And some people have said, well, that doesn't demand that there's a unique God like the God we're going to see developed later. No, this is the first occurrence of it in the context of Genesis chapter 1. But there are going to be many others. Now, drop down a little bit further. After you see the creation through all the different days, and drop down to verse 24. So verse 23, evening and morning on the fifth day, then God said, let the earth bring forth a living creature according to the kind. Notice, according to kind, there's a plan there. Cattle and creeping thing and so forth. And the beast of the earth he made according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, everything that creeps on the earth. Then watch what it says here. Then God said, plurality, let us, plurality, make man in our plurality image, according to our plurality likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So it says God, inherently referring to the plurality of everything that is God, created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. So God, always plural in these contexts, blessed them. The reason I bring that out is that's something that was understood, maybe not as fully as we understand it, and this is why I'm looking at all these passages that are listed here. Built into the very nature of the creation account were hints, and again, this is just one chapter. By the time we get to read through all the book of Genesis into the book of Exodus, the material that's happening live before the children of Israel and the things that they're hearing from Moses as he's going before Pharaoh, this is going to be repeated. The relational God, the inherent relations within the Godhead are such that he wants you to come into relationship with him. Not just the singular God that exists as God the Father, but God the Father, God the Son, and God the Spirit. Now that's an incredible thing. Now, I want to look at another passage, and this is probably the last thing we look at. That I'm looking, I'm scanning to see if I've alluded to it here, but these are all Old Testament texts. Let me get you to look at the book of John. And the book of John, the 17th chapter. As you're turning there, John 17, there's a dynamic in John that talks about the development of relationship between the Father and the Son. John chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And it develops further as you go through the text. And it shows that the relationship between Father and Son is a relationship that includes also the Spirit in other contexts, but ultimately is a relationship that includes all humanity. Now watch what we see in John chapter 17. This is significant about the plurality of the nature of God, which is what we're talking about here. So this is Jesus in his prayer. I'm going to scan it starting the beginning of the chapter and then hit down to what I want to look at in verses 20 and following. Father, the hour has come, glorify your Son. Notice, Father, Son, two distinct beings. One of the models of some forms of Pentecostalism, and this is not to criticize, but just to observe, is that there are many who are called oneness Pentecostals. What does that mean? They believe that there was a Father, Son, and Spirit, but they never existed all three at the same time, but they went from Father to Son to Spirit. So there was only one existed at any given time. Now watch this. Here's Jesus on the earth, equal to Father, the incarnate form of the Father, speaking to himself, speaking to the Father. Father, the hour has come, glorify your Son, that your Son may glorify you. Now notice, Father, Son, Son, glorify you. So all of those things are identifying two key individuals. Now there's more. So as you, the Father, have given him, the Son, authority over all men, that he, the Son, should give eternal life to as many as you, the Father, have given him, the Son. So there's this dynamic of Father, Son, talking about each other and to each other in this context of the prayer. That's one element I want us to note. All right, and it continues as you go further. I, the Son, have glorified you, the Father. I, the Son, have finished the work which you, the Father, have given me, the Son, to do. And now, O Father. And so sometimes the pronouns aren't identified specifically. You have to follow the text in which you see the Son speaking to the Father. But then he will sometimes identify specifically as the Father to whom he's speaking. I've glorified you on the earth. I've finished the work which you've given me to do. And now, O Father, glorify me. Father, me with yourself. Father, with the glory which I, the Son, had with you, the Father, before the world was. So notice that dynamic back and forth there. The point is, there are at least two parts of the Godhead that are mentioned as being referring to each other, right? Not in any kind of hierarchy way, not in any kind of way other than reinforcing the concept of relational God that existed from the creation. All right? So that continues as he's going to talk about his prayer for the disciples, and not only his prayer for the disciples, but for all those who are going to come to a knowledge of truth by means of those disciples. So Jesus shared with them, they're going to share with others. That's part of the process of evangelism that we'll see in our Sunday morning lesson. All right, drop down to verse 18. As you, the Father, sent me into the world, I have sent them. So notice the relationship shifts. Father sends the Son sends them, in this context referring to the apostles into the world. And for their sakes I sanctify myself, that they may also be sanctified by the truth. Now watch this. I do not pray for these alone, the apostles, but also for those, next generation of Christians, who will believe in me through their word, that is the apostles. So the Father-Son relationship extends to that of the apostles, and he mentions how much he loves them as the Father did before. And then he says that's going to continue to the next generation. That they all, following generations, may be one. That hasn't ended for 2,000 years. As you, Father, are in me. So notice constant references to personal pronouns, not identifying the same individual. Father and Son, constantly. And the Spirit's involved in revealing all this. And he's alluded to another context. But this is the Father-Son relationship specifically. Not done yet. That they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me. So the Father-Son relationship dynamic is part of the reason why people are going to understand and believe who Jesus is. That's built into what starts in Genesis chapter 1. And the glory which you have given me in this physical existence, that I have given them, that they may be one just as we are. Notice, oneness in religious faith is intended to replicate oneness in the Godhead. Father, Son, Spirit, three beings, all intertwined, all interconnected, all equal. They don't all do the same things, ascribe to different works and different roles and so forth. But notice the oneness that's mentioned from the standpoint of the disciples is dependent upon oneness relational in deity. It goes all the way back to Genesis. It's not done yet. Now watch what he says. I and them and you and me, that they may be made perfect in one, that the world may know that you have sent me. So something about the unity of followers is going to convince the world. Now watch this language here. That the world may know, watch the language here, that you have sent me and have loved me and have loved them as you've loved me. That's incredible. Infinite love can't be diminished. God doesn't dial up and down his love. What God loves is the object of his loves. It's always full tilt. They are loved by the Father just as the Father loved the Son. That's multiple relational here. Father-Son love, but also love from Father to others. That's part of the dynamic that's brought out here. He's not done. All right? So I and them and you and me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that you've sent me and have loved them as you have loved me. Watch this. Father, I desire that they also whom you have gave me may be with you, may be with me where I am, that they may behold my glory which you have given me. Now watch this. For you loved me, look at the language, before the foundation of the world. So the Father-Son love that he's talking about in the context of Jesus' physical incarnation on the earth is not the only time that the Father and Son had love for each other. This text tells us that before the creation of the world, alluded to in Genesis 1:1, that there was an interdynamic of love between Father, Son, and Spirit. This just refers to Father and Son. That's foundational for the relationship that God calls Israel to. This is the relationship that you have. You not only have this relationship by a God who physically delivered you from the land of Egypt and physically brought you through the Sinai and physically brought you to the land of Canaan, but who has sustained you with a love that he has for the Son, equal love that he has for you, the love that he had for the Son even before the foundation of the world. That's the God we're talking about. And that's why Jesus is often introduced as creator, equal in place and time, from the standpoint of physical creation, to the Father. And that's why he's referred to as the Redeemer in that context. And so Genesis 1 is laden with hints of what's going to come. All right? So I'm going to segue into something that's absolutely stupid, goofy, okay? Just assume that there's a point here. Anybody ever watch a Hallmark movie? Are they all alike?
One was filmed here.
What? That's correct. One was filmed here. I remember we saw that not too long ago. Do they all have pretty much the same plot? Can you figure out what they're about in the first 5 minutes? You know, The main characters are introduced. It's always an accidental bumping into each other, whatever, and sometimes a little accident, whatever. And there's an animosity between the guy and the gal and whatever. But you look at it and say, those are going to be the key, you know, players, and they're going to end up loving each other. The point is, in the beginning, you can see how it's going to end. And there are all kinds of dynamics that happen in the next 2 hours. Lots of commercials to sell you junk that you don't need. And at the end, you say, look, I saw in the beginning what's going to happen at the end. Bible's not a Hallmark movie. But you can, and it's not Dr. Seuss either, just to make sure we understand that. But you can see in the beginning what's going to happen at the end when you look closely at the details that are brought out in the first chapter. This is part of the beauty of studying the principles that are beneath the text in the opening chapters of Genesis. And it only gets better, wider, and deeper as you go further along. All right, we've only got a couple minutes to go. This is number two, and like I said, I've created two sites for the study we're doing on Wednesday. That's already up, and the study we're doing on Sunday morning, that's already up, and I'm working on finishing the one for this study. All those things will be up as well. All the audio, the visual, the slides, and the links to them will be up soon as well. So hopefully I'll get that done in the next day or so. Any questions or comments? And as we go forward, I want to slow down and allow more time for discussion like we're doing in James on Wednesday night. Any questions or comments before we close with prayer? Yes, Rod. No Dr. Seuss stuff, right? All right. Go ahead. I'm sorry I'm picking on you, but when you said that this morning, when I asked for a piece of literature written in history and you come up with Dr. Seuss, I'm thinking, no, he didn't say that. So that just resonates with me. I love you, brother. I appreciate that, but that just threw me for a loop this morning. There's more. Listen, he's written a lot of good stuff. I'm not, you know, red fish, blue fish. Okay, go ahead. I apologize.
I couldn't think of anything else. I felt like you were looking at me. The only thing that came up in my head was Dr. Seuss.
That's all right. That's okay. So you were going to say something really significant now.
Maybe not.
No, go ahead. You had a question.
What does axiomatic mean?
Ah, thank you. An axiom is a principle that's self-evident.
Okay.
All right, so an axiom, and if you look up the definition of the term, it might be, you know, defined in a little bit more highfalutin way, but it's something that's self-evidently true. Nothing comes from nothing. You know, creation ex nihilo, you might say, well, wait a minute, there's a concept of something coming out of nothing, but it overlooks the fact that there's something that's behind the process, and that's the God who stands outside of time.
The beginning chapter of Genesis, the earth was formed and had no form. I mean,
that's
it was
right. Initially,
form.
Yes.
There was nothing. It was inert. It was empty.
Yeah.
So your previous sentence says nothing can come from nothing.
That's correct.
So then there has to be a reason.
There had to be something.
There are 1,100 different varieties of trees, oceans, all this
other stuff. There's something that developed.
That's right.
And the plan, and I'm glad you brought that out.
It didn't come from nothing, came from nothing.
Right.
Because we already established that it could have been a gas ball, and it could have been cooled, and it could have been nothing.
Yeah. And the other thing, and I'm glad you said that, we're not there yet. We're going to see that as we're going further, and this is going to come up with reference to genetics and stuff, is that everything is reproducing according to a pattern. Everything reproduces according to kind. And so the whole Carl von Linn, Carolus Linnaeus didn't develop the taxonomic system until a few centuries ago. But the model that exists there, things reproducing after their kind, was introduced in that context that still maintains even today. All right.
One minor one.
Yeah.
Is there really a form of prophetic time for God?
Say that again. Is there
prophetic time? What time is to God? What time is to us? I mean, the realm that one day on earth or a million days on earth is equal to 1 second of God or whatever. Yeah. That's pathetic.
Yeah.
So is there such a thing?
There's a, and that's just indicated to allude that God, that's just, God works things out on a time schedule that's according to what he did and what he wants to accomplish rather than what we do. One of the things that's beautiful, it talks about Jesus came in the fullness of time. It's not like God had a watch. He said, it's time for Jesus to come. But there was a set of parameters, a set of circumstances, background, and so forth, that was going to be ripe for when it was that Jesus was going to come. And that's spelled out in detail in both the Old and New Testament. All right, it's 7 o'clock straight up. Let's stop. We'll end with a word of prayer. If there's any announcements that we need to make, we'll do that after we conclude with that prayer. Let's bow together. Our Heavenly Father, we're thankful for this time that we spent together, thankful for the ability that we have to read, to think, and to reason, and understand who you are and what you're like. We're thankful for your love for us, demonstrated in the relationship you have with your Son and your Spirit, that we become part of as we become yours. We're thankful for the incredible revelation that you brought to us in your Word, and we're thankful that we can read, think, and study about it in such a way that we can know more about who you are and how much you love us. Help us to love you in return. Help us to share who you are in return, and to be holy as you are holy as we go through life. I ask all of this in the name of your Son, the Christ. Amen.